morning. On the way down to the city hall with the boy and the gun, I apologized for the village cut-up stuff I had put in the early part of the shakedown, explaining I had to get under your skin, and that was the best way I knew. The way you'd talked about the girl showed me you were too good an actor to be broken down by straight hammering. He winced and said slowly, "That wasn't acting altogether. When I was in danger, facing the gallows, she didn't seem so important to me. I can't now quite understand fully why I did what I did. Do you know what I mean? That somehow makes the whole thing and me cheap. I mean, the whole thing from the beginning." I couldn't find anything to say except something meaningless, like, "Things happen that way." In the chief's office, we found one of the men who had been on the storming party the night before, a red-faced official named Biddle. He goggled at me with curious gray eyes, but asked no questions about the King Street doings. Biddle called in a young lawyer named Dart from the prosecuting attorney's office. Albury was repeating his story to Biddle, Dart, and a stenographer when the chief of police, looking as if he had just crawled out of bed, arrived. "Well, it certainly is fine to see you," Noonan said, pumping my hand up and down while patting my back. "By God, you had a narrow one last night, the rats. I was dead sure they'd got you till we kicked the doors in and found the joint empty. Tell me how those son-of-a-guns got out of there." "A couple of your men let them out the back door, took them through the house and back, and sent them away in a department car. They took me along so I couldn't tip you off." "A couple of my men did that?" he asked, with no appearance of surprise. "Well, well. What kind of looking men were they?" I described them. "Shore and Reardon," he said. "I might have known it. Now what's all this?" nodding his fat face at Albury. I told him briefly while the boy went on dictating his statement. The chief chuckled and said, "Well, well, I did whisper an injustice. I'll have to hunt him up and square myself. So you landed the boy. That certainly is fine. Congratulations and thanks." He shook my hand again. "You'll not be leaving our city now, will you?" "Not just yet." "That's fine," he assured me. I went out for breakfast and lunch. Then I treated myself to a shave and haircut, sent a telegram to the agency asking to have Dick Foley and Mickey Linehan shipped to Personville, stopped in my room for a change of clothes, and set out for my client's house. Old Elihu was wrapped in blankets in an armchair at a sunny window. He gave me a stubby hand and thanked me for catching his son's murderer. I made some more or less appropriate reply. I didn't ask him how he had got the news. "The check I gave you last night," he said, "is only fair pay for the work you have done."
"Your son's check more than covered that."
"Then call mine a bonus."
"The Continental's got rules against taking bonuses or rewards," I said. His face began to redden.
"Well, damn it."
"You haven't forgotten that your check was to cover the cost of investigating crime and corruption in Personville, have you?" I asked.
"That was nonsense," he snorted. "We were excited last night. That's called off."
"Not with me." He threw a lot of profanity around. Then,
"It's my money, and I won't have it wasted on a lot of damn foolery. If you won't take it for what you've done, give it back to me."
"Stop yelling at me," I said. "I'll give you nothing except a good job of city cleaning. That's what you bargained for, and that's what you're going to get. You know now that your son was killed by young Albury and not by your playmates. They know now that Thaler wasn't helping you double-cross them. With your son dead, you've been able to promise them that the newspapers won't dig up any more dirt. All's lovely and peaceful again. I told you I expected something like that. That's why I sewed you up. And you are sewed up. The check has been certified, so you can't stop payment. The letter of authority may not be as good as a contract, but you'll have to go into court to prove that it isn't. If you want that much of that kind of publicity, go ahead. I'll see that you get plenty. Your fat chief of police tried to assassinate me last night. I don't like that. I'm just mean enough to want to ruin him for it. Now I'm going to have my fun. I've got $10,000 of your money to play with. I'm going to use it opening Poisonville up from Adam's apple to ankles. I'll see that you get my reports as regularly as possible. I hope you enjoy them. And I went out of the house with his curses sizzling around my head. Chapter 8. A Tip on Kid Cooper. I spent most of the afternoon writing my 3 days' reports on the Donald Wilson operation. Then I sat around, burned Fatimas, and thought about the Elihu Wilson operation until dinner time. I went down to the hotel dining room and had just decided in favor of pounded rump steak with mushrooms when I heard myself being paged. The boy took me to one of the lobby booths. Dinah Brand's lazy voice came out of the receiver. "Max wants to see you. Can you drop in tonight?"
"Your place?"
"Yes." I promised to drop in and returned to the dining room and my meal. When I had finished eating, I went up to my room, fifth floor front. I unlocked the door and went in, snapping on the light. A bullet kissed a hole in the doorframe close to my noodle. More bullets made more holes in the door, doorframe, and wall, but by that time I had carried my noodle into a safe corner, one out of line with the window. Across the street, I knew, was a four-story office building with a roof a little above the level of my window. The roof would be dark. My light was on. There was no percentage in trying to peep out under those conditions. I looked around for something to chuck at the light globe, found a Gideon Bible, and chucked it. The bulb popped apart, giving me darkness. The shooting had stopped. I crept to the window, kneeling with an eye to one of its lower corners. The roof across the street was dark and too high for me to see beyond its rim. 10 minutes of this one-eyed spying got me nothing except a kink in my neck. I went to the phone and asked the girl to send the house copper up. He was a portly, white-mustached man with the round, underdeveloped forehead of a child. He wore a too small hat on the back of his head to show the forehead. His name was Kiever. He got too excited over the shooting. The hotel manager came in, a plump man with carefully controlled face, voice, and manner. He didn't get excited at all. He took the this-is-unheard-of-but-not-really-serious-of-course attitude of a street faker whose mechanical dingus flops during a demonstration. We risked light, getting a new globe, and added up the bullet holes. There were 10 of them. Police came, went, and returned to report no luck in picking up whatever trail there might have been. Noonan called up. He talked to the sergeant in charge of the police detail, and then to me.
"I just this minute heard about the shooting," he said. "Now who do you reckon would be after you like that?"
I couldn't guess. I lied.
"None of them touched you?"
"No."
"Well, that certainly is fine," he said heartily. "And we'll nail that baby, whoever he was. You can bet your life on that. Would you like me to leave a couple of the boys with you, just to see nothing else happens?"
"No, thanks."
"You can have them if you want them,"
he insisted. "No, thanks." He made me promise to call on him the first chance I got, told me the Pearsonville Police Department was at my disposal, gave me to understand that if anything happened to me, his whole life would be ruined, and I finally got rid of him. The police went away. I had my stuff moved into another room, one into which bullets couldn't be so easily funneled. Then I changed my clothes and set out for Hurricane Street to keep my date with the whispering gambler. Dinah Brand opened the door for me. Her big ripe mouth was rouged evenly this evening, but her brown hair still needed trimming, was parted haphazardly, and there were spots down the front of her orange silk dress.
"So you're still alive," she said.
I suppose nothing can be done about it. Come on in.
We went into her cluttered-up living room. Dan Rolf and Max Thaler were playing pinochle there. Rolf nodded to me. Thaler got up to shake hands. His hoarse, whispering voice said,
I hear you've declared war on Poisonville.
Don't blame me. I've got a client who wants the place ventilated.
Wanted, not wants,
he corrected me as we sat down.
Why don't you chuck it?
I made a speech. No, I don't like the way Poisonville has treated me. I've got my chance now, and I'm going to even up. I take it you're back in the club again, all brothers together, let bygones be bygones. You want to be let alone. There was a time when I wanted to be let alone. If I had been, maybe now I'd be riding back to San Francisco. But I wasn't. Especially I wasn't let alone by that fat Noonan. He's had 2 tries at my scalp in 2 days. That's plenty. Now it's my turn to run him ragged, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. Poisonville is ripe for the harvest. It's a job I like, and I'm going to do it.
While you last,
the gambler said. Yeah, I agreed. I was reading in the paper this morning about a fellow choking to death eating a chocolate eclair in bed.
That may be good, said Dinah Brand, her big body sprawled in an armchair. But it wasn't in this morning's paper.
She lit a cigarette and threw the match out of sight under the Chesterfield. The Lunger had gathered up the cards and was shuffling them over and over, purposelessly. Thaler frowned at me and said,
Wilson's willing for you to keep the 10 grand. Let it go at that.
I've got a mean disposition. Attempted assassinations make me mad.
That won't get you anything but a box. I'm for you. You kept Noonan from framing me. That's why I'm telling you, forget it and go back to Frisco.
I'm for you, I said. That's why I'm telling you, split with them. They crossed you up once. It'll happen again. Anyway, they're slated for the shoots. Get out while the getting's good.
I'm sitting too pretty, he said, and I'm able to take care of myself.
Maybe. But you know the racket's too good to last. You've had the cream of the pickings. Now it's getaway day. He shook his little dark head and told me,
I think you're pretty good, but I'm damned if I think you're good enough to crack this camp. It's too tight. If I thought you could swing it, I'd be with you. You know how I stand with Noonan, but you'll never make it. Chuck it.
No. I'm in it to the last nickel of Elihu's 10,000.
I told you he was too damned pig-headed to listen to reason,
Dinah Brand said, yawning.
Isn't there anything to drink in the dump, Dan?
The Lunger got up from the table and went out of the room. Thaler shrugged, said,
Have it your way. You're supposed to know what you're doing. Going to the fights tomorrow night?
I said I thought I would. Dan Rolf came in with gin and trimmings. We had a couple of drinks apiece. We talked about the fights. Nothing more was said about me versus Poisonville. The gambler apparently had washed his hands of me, but he didn't seem to hold my stubbornness against me. He even gave me what seemed to be a straight tip on the fights, telling me any bet on the main event would be good if its maker remembered that Kid Cooper would probably knock Ike Bush out in the 6th round. He seemed to know what he was talking about, and it didn't seem to be news to the others. I left a little after 11, returning to the hotel without anything happening.
Chapter 9. A Black Knife.
I woke next morning with an idea in my skull. Personville had only some 40,000 inhabitants. It shouldn't be hard to spread news. 10 o'clock found me out spreading it. I did my spreading in pool rooms, cigar stores, speakeasies, soft drink joints, and on street corners, wherever I found a man or two loafing. My spreading technique was something like this. Got a match? Thanks. Going to the fights tonight?
I hear Ike Bush takes a dive in the sixth. It ought to be straight. I got it from Whisper. Yeah, they all are.
People like inside stuff, and anything that had Thaler's name to it was very inside in Personville. The news spread nicely. Half the men I gave it to worked almost as hard as I did spreading it, just to show they knew what was what. When I started out, 7-4 was being offered that Ike Bush would win, and 2-3 that he would win by a knockout. By 2 o'clock, none of the joints taking bets were offering anything better than even money, and by 3:30, Kid Cooper was a 2-1 favorite. I made my last stop a lunch counter, where I tossed the news out to a waiter and a couple of customers while eating a hot beef sandwich. When I went out, I found a man waiting by the door for me. He had bowed legs and a long, sharp jaw like a hog's. He nodded and walked down the street beside me, chewing a toothpick and squinting sideways into my face. At the corner, he said,
"I know for a fact that ain't so."
"What?" I asked.
"About Ike Bush flopping."
"I know for a fact that ain't so." "Then it oughtn't bother you any. But the wise money's going 2-1 on Cooper, and he's not that good unless Bush lets him be." The hog jaw spit out the mangled toothpick and snapped yellow teeth at me.
"He told me his own self that Cooper was set up for him last night, and he wouldn't do nothing like that, not to me."
"Friend of yours?"
"Not exactly. But he knows I..."
"Hey, listen.
Did Whisper give you that, on the level?"
"On the level," he cursed bitterly.
"And I put my last $35 in the world on that rat on his say-so. Me! That could send him over for..."
He broke off and looked down the street. "Could send him over for what?" I asked.
"Plenty," he said. "Nothing."
I had a suggestion. "If you've got something on him, maybe we ought to talk it over. I wouldn't mind seeing Bush win myself. If what you've got is any good, what's the matter with putting it up to him?" He looked at me, at the sidewalk, fumbled in his vest pocket for another toothpick, put it in his mouth and mumbled, "Who are you?" I gave him a name, something like Hunter or Hunt or Huntington, and asked him his. He said his name was McSwain, Bob McSwain, and I could ask anybody in town if it wasn't right. I said I believed him and asked, "What do you say? Will we put the squeeze to Bush?" Little hard lights came into his eyes and died.
"No," he gulped. "I ain't that kind of fellow. I never..."
"You never did anything but let people chip you. You don't have to go up against him, McSwain. Give me the dope and I'll make the play, if it's any good." He thought that over, licking his lips, letting the toothpick fall down to stick on his coat front.
"You wouldn't let on about me having any part in it?" he asked. "I belong here, and I wouldn't stand a chance if it got out. And you won't turn him up. You'll just use it to make him fight?"
"Right." He took my hand excitedly and demanded,
"Honest to God."
"Honest to God."
"His real name is Al Kennedy. He was in on the Keystone Trust knockover in Philly 2 years ago, when Scissors Haggerty's mob croaked two messengers. Al didn't do the killing, but he was in on the caper. He used to scrap around Philly. The rest of them got copped, but he made the sneak. That's why he's sticking out here in the bushes. That's why he won't never let them put his mug in the papers or on any cards. That's why he's a pork and beaner when he's as good as the best, see? This Ike Bush is Al Kennedy that the Philly Bulls want for the Keystone trick, see? He was in on the..."
"I see, I see." I stopped the merry-go-round. "The next thing is to get to see him. How do we do that?"
"He flops at the Maxwell on Union Street. I guess maybe he'd be there now, resting up for the mill."
"Resting for what? He doesn't know he's going to fight. We'll give it a try, though."
We? Where do you get the we at? You said you swore you'd keep me covered."
"Yeah," I said, "I remember that now. What does he look like?"
"A black-headed kid, kinda slim, with one tin ear and eyebrows that run straight across. I don't know if you can make him like it.
Leave that to me. Where'll I find you afterwards?
I'll be hanging around Murray's. Mind you, don't tip my mitt. You promised.
The Maxwell was one of a dozen hotels along Union Street with narrow front doors between stores and shabby stairs leading up to second-story offices. The Maxwell's office was simply a wide place in the hall with a key and mail rack behind a wooden counter that needed paint just as badly. A brass bell and a dirty daybook register were on the counter. Nobody was there. I had to run back 8 pages before I found Ike Bush, Salt Lake City, 214, written in the book. The pigeonhole that had that number was empty. I climbed more steps and knocked on a door that had it. Nothing came of that. I tried it 2 or 3 times more and then turned back to the stairs. Somebody was coming up. I stood at the top waiting for a look at him. There was just light enough to see by. He was a slim, muscular lad in army shirt, blue suit, gray cap, black eyebrows that made a straight line above his eyes. I said, "Hello." He nodded without stopping or saying anything. "Win tonight?" I asked.
"Hope so,"
he said shortly, passing me. I let him take 4 steps toward his room before I told him, "So do I. I'd hate to have to ship you back to Philly, Al." He took another step, turned around very slowly, rested a shoulder against the wall, let his eyes get sleepy, and grunted, "Huh?" If you were smacked down in the 6th or any other round by a palooka like Kid Cooper, it'd make me peevish, I said. "Don't do it, Al. You don't want to go back to Philly." The youngster put his chin down in his neck and came back to me. When he was within arm's reach, he stopped, letting his left side turn a bit to the front. His hands were hanging loose. Mine were in my overcoat pockets. He said, "Huh?" again. I said, "Try to remember that. If Ike Bush doesn't turn in a win tonight, Al Kennedy will be riding east in the morning." He lifted his left shoulder an inch. I moved the gun around in my pocket. "Enough," he grumbled. "Where do you get that stuff about me not winning?" "Just something I heard. I didn't think there was anything in it except maybe a ducat back to Philly."
"I had to bust your jaw, you fat crook."
"Now's the time to do it," I advised him. "If you win tonight, you're not likely to see me again. If you lose, you'll see me, but your hands won't be loose." I found McSwain in Murray's, a Broadway pool room.
"Did you get to him?" he asked.
"Yeah. It's all fixed. If he doesn't blow town or say something to his backers or just pay no attention to me, or..." McSwain developed a lot of nervousness.
"You better damn sight be careful," he warned me. "They might try to put you out of the way.
I gotta see a fella down the street." And he deserted me. Poisonville's prize fighting was done in a big wooden ex-casino in what had once been an amusement park on the edge of town. When I got there at 8:30, most of the population seemed to be on hand, packed tight in close rows of folding chairs on the main floor, packed tighter on benches in 2 dinky balconies. Smoke, stink, heat, noise. My seat was in the 3rd row, ringside. Moving down to it, I discovered Dan Rolfe in an aisle seat not far away, with Dinah Brand beside him. She had her hair trimmed at last, and marcelled, and looked like a lot of money in a big gray fur coat.
"Get down on Cooper?"
she asked after we had swapped hellos. "No. You playing him heavy?"
"Not as heavy as I'd like. We held off, thinking the odds would get better, but they went to hell."
"Everybody in town seems to know Bush is going to dive," I said. "I saw 100 put on Cooper at 4-1 a few minutes ago." I leaned past Rolfe and put my mouth close to where the gray fur collar hid the girl's ear, whispering, "The dive is off. Better copper your bets while there's time."
Her big bloodshot eyes went wide and dark with anxiety, greed, curiosity, suspicion.
"You mean it?" she asked huskily.
"Yeah." She chewed her reddened lips, frowned, asked,
"Where'd you get it?"
I wouldn't say. She chewed her mouth some more and asked, "Is Max on?" "I haven't seen him. Is he here?"
"I suppose so," she said absentmindedly, a distant look in her eyes.
Her lips moved as if she were counting to herself. I said, "Take it or leave it, but it's a gut." She leaned forward to look sharply into my eyes, clicked her teeth together, opened her bag, and dragged out a roll of bills the size of a coffee can, part of the roll she pushed at Rolf.
"Here, Dan. Get it down on Bush. You've got an hour anyway to look over the odds."
Rolf took the money and went off on his errand. I took his seat. She put a hand on my forearm and said,
"Christ help you if you've made me drop that dough."
I pretended the idea was ridiculous. The preliminary bouts got going. Four round affairs between assorted hams. I kept looking for Thaler, but couldn't see him. The girl squirmed beside me, paying little attention to the fighting, dividing her time between asking me where I had got my information and threatening me with hellfire and damnation if it turned out to be a bust. The semifinal was on when Rolf came back and gave the girl a handful of tickets. She was straining her eyes over them when I left for my own seat. Without looking up, she called to me.
"Wait outside for us when it's over."
Kid Cooper climbed into the ring while I was squeezing through to my seat. He was a ruddy, straw-haired, solid-built boy with a dented face and too much meat around the top of his lavender trunks. Ike Bush, alias Al Kennedy, came through the ropes in the opposite corner. His body looked better, slim, nicely ridged, snaky, but his face was pale, worried. They were introduced, went to the center of the ring for the usual instructions, returned to their corners, shed bathrobes, stretched on the ropes, the gong rang, and the scrap was on. Cooper was a clumsy bum. He had a pair of wide swings that might have hurt when they landed, but anybody with 2 feet could have kept away from them. Bush had class, nimble legs, a smooth, fast left hand, and a right that got away quick. It would have been murder to put Cooper in the ring with the slim boy if he had been trying, but he wasn't. That is, he wasn't trying to win. He was trying not to and had his hands full doing it. Cooper waddled flat-footed around the ring, throwing his wide swings at everything from the lights to the corner posts. His system was simply to turn them loose and let them take their chances. Bush moved in and out, putting a glove on the ruddy boy whenever he wanted to, but not putting anything in the glove. The customers were booing before the first round was over. The second round was just as sour. I didn't feel so good. Bush didn't seem to have been much influenced by our little conversation. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Dinah Brand trying to catch my attention. She looked hot. I took care not to have my attention caught. The roommate act in the ring was continued in the third round to the tune of yelled throw-em-outs, why don't you kiss-ems, and make-em-fights from the seats. The pug's waltz brought them around to the corner nearest me just as the booing broke off for a moment. I made a megaphone of my hands and bawled, "Back to Philly, Al!" Bush's back was to me. He wrestled Cooper around, shoving him into the rope so he, Bush, faced my way. From somewhere far back in another part of the house, another yelling voice came.
"Back to Philly, Al!"
McSwain, I supposed. A drunk off to one side lifted his puffy face and bawled the same thing, laughing as if it were a swell joke. Others took up the cry for no reason at all except that it seemed to disturb Bush. His eyes jerked from side to side under the black bar of his eyebrows. One of Cooper's wild mitts clouted the slim boy on the side of the jaw. Ike Bush piled down at the referee's feet. The referee counted 5 in 2 seconds, but the gong cut him off. I looked over at Dinah Brand and laughed.
There wasn't anything else to do. She looked at me and didn't laugh. Her face was sick as Dan Rolfe's, but angrier. Bush's handlers dragged him into his corner and rubbed him up, not working very hard at it. He opened his eyes and watched his feet. The gong was tapped. Kid Cooper paddled out, hitching up his trunks. Bush waited until the bum was in the center of the ring and then came to him, fast. Bush's left glove went down, out, practically out of sight in Cooper's belly. Cooper said, "Ugh," and backed away, folding up. Bush straightened him with a right-hand poke in the mouth and sank the left again. Cooper said, "Ugh," again, and had trouble with his knees. Bush cuffed him once on each side of the head, cocked his right, carefully pushed Cooper's face into position with a long left, and threw his right hand straight from under his jaw to Cooper's. Everybody in the house felt the punch. Cooper hit the floor, bounced, and settled there. It took the referee half a minute to count 10 seconds. It would have been just the same if he had taken half an hour. Kid Cooper was out. When the referee had finally stalled through the count, he raised Bush's hand. Neither of them looked happy. A high twinkle of light caught my eye. A short silvery streak slanted down from one of the small balconies. A woman screamed. The silvery streak ended its flashing slant in the ring, with a sound that was partly a thud, partly a snap. Ike Bush took his arm out of the referee's hand and pitched down on top of Kid Cooper. A black knife handle stuck out of the nape of Bush's neck. Chapter 10. Crime Wanted, Male or Female. Half an hour later, when I left the building, Dinah Brand was sitting at the wheel of a pale blue little Marmon, talking to Max Thaler, who stood in the road. The girl's square chin was tilted up. Her big red mouth was brutal around the words it shaped, and the lines crossing its ends were deep, hard. The gambler looked as unpleasant as she. His pretty face was yellow and tough as oak. When he talked, his lips were paper thin. It seemed to be a nice family party. I wouldn't have joined it if the girl hadn't seen me and called. "My God, I thought you were never coming." I went over to the car. Thaler looked across the hood at me with no friendliness at all. "Last night I advised you to go back to Frisco." His whisper was harsher than anybody's shout could have been. "Now I'm telling you." "Thanks just the same," I said as I got in beside the girl. While she was stirring the engine up, he said to her, "This isn't the first time you've sold me out. It's the last." She put the car in motion, turned her head back over her shoulder, and sang to him, "To hell, my love, with you." We rode into town rapidly. "Is Bush dead?" she asked as she twisted the car into Broadway. "Decidedly." When they turned him over, the point of the knife was sticking out in front. "He ought to have known better than to double-cross them. Let's get something to eat. I'm almost 1,100 ahead on the night's doings, so if the boyfriend doesn't like it, it's just too bad. How'd you come out?"
"Didn't bet."
"So your Max doesn't like it?"
"Didn't bet," she cried. "What kind of an ass are you? Who ever heard of anybody not betting when they had a thing like that sewed up?"
"I wasn't sure it was sewed up, so Max didn't like the way things turned out."
"You guessed it. He dropped plenty. And then he gets sore with me because I had sense enough to switch over and get in on the win."
She stopped the car violently in front of a Chinese restaurant.
"The hell with him, the little tinhorn runt."
Her eyes were shiny because they were wet. She jabbed a handkerchief into them as we got out of the car.
"My God, I'm hungry," she said, dragging me across the sidewalk. "Will you buy me a ton of chow mein?"
She didn't eat a ton of it, but she did pretty well, putting away a piled-up dish of her own and half of mine. Then we got back into the Marmon and rode out to her house. Dan Rolfe was in the dining room. A water glass and a brown bottle with no label stood on the table in front of him. He sat straight up in his chair, staring at the bottle. The room smelled of laudanum. Dinah Brand slid her fur coat off, letting it fall half on a chair and half on the floor, and snapped her fingers at the lunger, saying impatiently, "Did you collect?" Without looking up from the bottle, he took a pad of paper money out of his inside pocket and dropped it on the table. The girl grabbed it, counted the bills twice, smacked her lips, and stuffed the money in her bag. She went out to the kitchen and began chopping ice. I sat down and lit a cigarette. Rolf stared at his bottle. He and I never seemed to have much to say to one another. Presently, the girl brought in some gin, lemon juice, seltzer, and ice. We drank, and she told Rolf, "Max is sore as hell. He heard you've been running around putting last-minute money on Bush. And the little monkey thinks I double-crossed him. What did I have to do with it? All I did was what any sensible person would have done. Get in on the win. I didn't have any more to do with it than a baby, did I?" she asked me. "No. Of course not. What's the matter with Max is he's afraid the others will think he was in on it too, that Dan was putting his dough down as well as mine. Well, that's his hard luck. He can go climb trees for all I care, the lousy little runt. Another drink would go good." She poured another for herself and for me. Rolf hadn't touched his first one. He said, still staring at the brown bottle, "You can hardly expect him to be hilarious about it." The girl scowled and said disagreeably, "I can expect anything I want. And he's got no right to talk to me that way. He doesn't own me. Maybe he thinks he does, but I'll show him different." She emptied her glass, banged it on the table, and twisted around in her chair to face me. "Is that on the level about your having $10,000 of Elihu Wilson's money to use cleaning up the city?" "Yeah." Her bloodshot eyes glistened hungrily. "And if I help you, will I get some of the ten?"
"You can't do that, Dinah." Rolf's voice was thick, but gently firm, as if he were talking to a child. "That would be utterly filthy." The girl turned her face slowly toward him. Her mouth took on the look it had worn while talking to Thaler.
"I'm going to do it," she said. "That makes me utterly filthy, does it?"
He didn't say anything, didn't look up from the bottle. Her face got red, hard, cruel. Her voice was soft, cooing.
"It's just too bad that a gentleman of your purity, even if he is a bit consumptive, has to associate with a filthy bum like me."
"That can be remedied," he said slowly, getting up. He was laudanum to the scalp. Dinah Brand jumped out of her chair and ran around the table to him. He looked at her with blank, dopey eyes. She put her face close to his and demanded,
"So I'm too utterly filthy for you now, am I?"
He said evenly,
"I said to betray your friends to this chap would be utterly filthy, and it would."
She caught one of his thin wrists and twisted it until he was on his knees. Her other hand, open, beat his hollow-cheeked face half a dozen times on each side, rocking his head from side to side. He could have put his free arm up to protect his face, but didn't. She let go his wrist, turned her back to him, and reached for gin and seltzer. She was smiling. I didn't like the smile. He got up, blinking. His wrist was red where she had held it, his face bruised. He steadied himself upright and looked at me with dull eyes. With no change in the blankness of his face and eyes, he put a hand under his coat, brought out a black automatic pistol, and fired at me. But he was too shaky for either speed or accuracy. I had time to toss a glass at him. The glass hit his shoulder. His bullet went somewhere overhead. I jumped before he got the next one out, jumped at him, was close enough to knock the gun down. The second slug went into the floor. I socked his jaw. He fell away from me and lay where he fell. I turned around.
Dinah Brand was getting ready to bat me over the head with the seltzer bottle, a heavy glass siphon that would have made pulp of my skull.
"Don't," I yelped. "You didn't have to bust him like that," she snarled.
"Well, it's done. You'd better get him straightened out." She put down the siphon, and I helped her carry him up to his bedroom. When he began moving his eyes, I left her to finish the work and went down to the dining room again. She joined me there 15 minutes later.
"He's all right," she said. "But you could have handled them without that."
"Yeah, but I did that for him. Know why he took the shot at me?"
"So I'd have nobody to sell Max out to?"
"No, because I'd seen you maul him around."
"That doesn't make sense to me," she said. "I was the one who did it."
"He's in love with you, and this isn't the first time you've done it. He acted like he had learned there was no use matching muscle with you, but you can't expect him to enjoy having another man see you slap his face."
"I used to think I knew men," she complained. "But by God, I don't. They're lunatics, all of them."
So I poked him to give him back some of his self-respect. You know, treated him as I would a man instead of a down-and-outer who could be slapped around by girls.
"Anything you say, I give up. We ought to have a drink."
We had the drink, and I said, "You were saying you'd work with me if there was a cut of the Wilson money in it for you?" "There is."
"How much?"
"Whatever you earn. Whatever what you do is worth."
"That's uncertain."
"So's your help, so far as I know."
"Is it? I can give you the stuff, brother. Loads of it. And don't think I can't. I'm a girl who knows her Poisonville."
She looked down at her gray-stockinged knees, waved one leg at me, and exclaimed indignantly,
"Look at that! Another run! Did you ever see anything to beat it? Honest to God, I'm going barefoot."
"Your legs are too big," I told her. "They put too much strain on the material."
"That'll do out of you. What's your idea of how to go about purifying our village?"
"If I haven't been lied to, Thaler, Pete the Finn, Lou Yard, and Noonan are the men who've made Poisonville the sweet-smelling mess it is. Old Elihu comes in for his share of the blame, too, but it's not all his fault, maybe. Besides, he's my client, even if he doesn't want to be, so I'd like to go easy on him. The closest I've got to an idea is to dig up any and all the dirty work I can that might implicate the others and run it out. Maybe I'll advertise, 'Crime wanted, male or female.' If they're as crooked as I think they are, I shouldn't have a lot of trouble finding a job or two that I can hang on them."
"Is that what you were up to when you uncooked the fight?"
"That was only an experiment, just to see what would happen."
"So that's the way you scientific detectives work. My God, for a fat, middle-aged, hard-boiled, pig-headed guy, you've got the vaguest way of doing things I ever heard of."
"Plans are all right sometimes," I said, "and sometimes just stirring things up is all right, if you're tough enough to survive and keep your eyes open so you'll see what you want when it comes to the top."
"That ought to be good for another drink," she said.
Chapter 11. The Swell Spoon. We had another drink. She put her glass down, licked her lips, and said, "If stirring things up is your system, I've got a swell spoon for you. Did you ever hear of Noonan's brother, Tim? The one who committed suicide out at Mock Lake a couple of years ago?"
"No."
"You wouldn't have heard much good. Anyway, he didn't commit suicide. Max killed him."
"Yeah?"
"For God's sake, wake up! This I'm giving you is real. Noonan was like a father to Tim. Take the proof to him, and he'll be after Max like nobody's business. That's what you want, isn't it?"
"We've got proof."
Two people got to Tim before he died, and he told them Max had done it. They're both still in town, though one won't live a lot longer. How's that?
She looked as if she were telling the truth, though with women, especially blue-eyed women, that doesn't always mean anything.
Let's listen to the rest of it, I said. I like details and things.
You'll get them. You ever been out to Mock Lake? Well, it's our summer resort, 30 miles up the canyon road. It's a dump, but it's cool in summer, so it gets a good play. This was summer a year ago, the last weekend in August. I was out there with a fella named Holly. He's back in England now, but you don't care anything about that, because he's got nothing to do with it. He was a funny sort of old woman. Used to wear white silk socks turned inside out so the loose threads wouldn't hurt his feet. I got a letter from him last week. He's around here somewhere, but that doesn't make any difference. We were up there, and Max was up there with a girl he used to play around with, Myrtle Jennison. She's in the hospital now, city, dying of Bright's disease or something. She was a classy-looking kid then, a slender blonde. I always liked her, except that a few drinks made her too noisy. Tim Noonan was crazy about her, but she couldn't see anybody but Max that summer. Tim wouldn't let her alone. He was a big, good-looking Irishman, but a sap and a cheap crook who only got by because his brother was chief of police. Wherever Myrtle went, he'd pop up sooner or later. She didn't like to say anything to Max about it, not wanting Max to do anything to put him in wrong with Tim's brother, the chief. So, of course, Tim showed up at Mock Lake this Saturday. Myrtle and Max were just by themselves. Holly and I were with a bunch, but I saw Myrtle to talk to, and she told me she had got a note from Tim asking her to meet him for a few minutes that night in one of the little arbor things on the hotel grounds. He said if she didn't, he would kill himself. That was a laugh for us, the big false alarm. I tried to talk Myrtle out of going, but she had just enough booze in her to feel gay, and she said she was going to give him an earful. We were all dancing in the hotel that night. Max was there for a while, and then I didn't see him anymore. Myrtle was dancing with a fella named Rutgers, a lawyer here in town. After a while, she left him and went out one of the side doors. She winked at me when she passed, so I knew she was going down to see Tim. She had just got out when I heard the shot. Nobody else paid any attention to it. I suppose I wouldn't have noticed it either if I hadn't known about Myrtle and Tim. I told Holly I wanted to see Myrtle and went out after her by myself. I must have been about 5 minutes behind her in getting out. When I got outside, I saw lights down by one of the summer houses, and people. I went down there, and this talking is thirsty work.
I poured out a couple of hookers of gin. She went into the kitchen for another siphon and more ice. We mixed them up, drank, and she settled down to her tale again.
There was Tim Noonan, dead, with a hole in his temple and his gun lying beside him. Perhaps a dozen people were standing around, hotel people, visitors, one of Noonan's men, a dick named McSwain. As soon as Myrtle saw me, she took me away from the crowd, back in the shade of some trees. "Max killed him," she said. "What'll I do?" I asked her about it. She told me she had seen the flash of the gun, and at first she thought Tim had killed himself after all. She was too far away, and it was too dark for her to see anything else. When she ran down to him, he was rolling around, moaning, "He didn't have to kill me over her, I'd have..." She couldn't make out the rest of it. He was rolling around, bleeding from the hole in his temple. Myrtle was afraid Max had done it. But she had to be sure, so she knelt down and tried to pick up Tim's head, asking, "Who did it, Tim?" He was almost gone, but before he passed out, he got enough strength to tell her, "Max." She kept asking me, "What'll I do?" I asked her if anybody else had heard Tim, and she said the dickhead. He came running up while she was trying to lift Tim's head. She didn't think anybody else had been near enough to hear, but the dickhead. I didn't want Max to get in a jam over killing a mutt like Tim Noonan. Max didn't mean anything to me then, except that I liked him, and I didn't like any of the Noonans. I knew the Dick, McSwain. I used to know his wife. He had been a pretty good guy. Straight as ace, two, stray, four, five, till he got on the force. Then he went the way of the rest of them. His wife stood as much of it as she could and then left him. Knowing this Dick, I told Myrtle I thought we could fix things. A little Jack would ruin McSwain's memory, or if he didn't like that, Max could have him knocked off. She had Tim's note threatening suicide. If the Dick would play along, the hole in Tim's head from his own gun and the note would smooth everything over pretty. I left Myrtle under the trees and went out to hunt for Max. He wasn't around. There weren't many people there, and I could hear the hotel orchestra still playing dance music. I couldn't find Max, so I went back to Myrtle. She was all worked up over another idea. She didn't want Max to know that she had found out that he had killed Tim. She was afraid of him. See what I mean? She was afraid that if she and Max ever broke off, he'd put her out of the way if he knew she had enough on him to swing him. I know how she felt. I got the same notion later, and kept just as quiet as she did. So we figured that if it could be fixed up without his knowing about it, so much the better. I didn't want a show in it either. Myrtle went back alone to the group around Tim and got hold of McSwain. She took him off a little way and made the deal with him. She had some dough on her. She gave him 200 and a diamond ring that had cost a fella named Boyle 1,000. I thought he'd be back for more later, but he wasn't. He shot square with her. With the help of the letter, he put over the suicide story. Noonan knew there was something fishy about the layout, but he could never peg it. I think he suspected Max of having something to do with it, but Max had an airtight alibi. Trust him for that. And I think even Noonan finally counted him out. But Noonan never believed it happened the way it was made to look. He broke McSwain, kicked him off the force. Max and Myrtle slid apart a little while after that. No row or anything. They just slid apart. I don't think she ever felt easy around him again, though so far as I know, he never suspected her of knowing anything. She's sick now, as I told you, and hasn't got long to live. I think she'd not so much mind telling the truth if she were asked. McSwain's still hanging around town. He'd talk if there was something in it for him. Those two have got the stuff on Max, and wouldn't Noonan eat it up? Is that good enough to give you stirring up a start?
Couldn't it have been suicide? I asked. With Tim Noonan getting a last-minute bright idea to stick it on Max?
That four-flusher shoot himself? Not a chance.
Could Myrtle have shot him?
Noonan didn't overlook that one. But she couldn't have been a third of the distance down the slope when the shot was fired. Tim had powder marks on his head and hadn't been shot and rolled down the slope. Myrtle's out.
But Max had an alibi?
Yes, indeed. He always has. He was in the hotel bar on the other side of the building all the time. Four men said so. As I remember it, they said it openly and often, long before anybody asked them. There were other men in the bar who didn't remember whether Max had been there or not, but those four remembered. They'd remember anything Max wanted remembered.
Her eyes got large and then narrowed to black-fringed slits. She leaned toward me, upsetting her glass with an elbow.
Peak Murray was one of the four. He and Max are on the outs now. Peak might tell it straight now. He's got a pool room on Broadway.
This McSwain, does he happen to be named Bob? I asked. A bow-legged man with a long jaw like a hog's?
Yes. You know him?
By sight. What does he do now?
A small-time grifter. What do you think of the stack-up?
Not bad. Maybe I can use it.
Then let's talk scratch.
I grinned at the greed in her eyes and said, Not just yet, sister. We'll have to see how it works out before we start scattering pennies around. She called me a damned nickel nurser and reached for the gin. No more for me, thanks, I told her, looking at my watch. It's getting along toward 5 a.m. and I've got a busy day ahead. She decided she was hungry again. That reminded me that I was.
It took a half an hour or more to get waffles, ham, and coffee off the stove. It took some more time to get them into our stomachs and to smoke some cigarettes over extra cups of coffee. It was quite a bit after 6 when I got ready to leave. I went back to my hotel and got into a tub of cold water. It braced me a lot, and I needed bracing. At 40, I could get along on gin as a substitute for sleep, but not comfortably. When I had dressed, a